This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Grow connects you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights and weekends. There are no subscriptions, no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/try now today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/try now. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
How do you turn reasonable, people-loving citizens into a radicalized hate mob? This was the problem for the right for a very long time, until some very favorable circumstances, either by luck or design, enabled them to normalize the hatred they desired to foment. Today we see hate speech aplenty across newspaper front pages, media headlines, political manifestos, and every social media platform in existence. This level of incessant toxicity has become the norm, against which resistance is considered in itself extreme, despite that resistance having been itself the norm only months earlier. Here we are, beset by anger, frustration, and dwindling opportunities, and we have to resist the temptation to scapegoat those innocents whose precarious situations mirror our own. That is the challenge we now face. We have to resist the hatred we have always considered anathema to dignity and understanding. Two and a mic, clocking out. Enjoy.
Dong weche pek kudwelo mabiro etu anda mic. Dong parodit kod jok mawuoye tu anda mic. Seche tin sud buta wawinjie tu anda mic. Wola wachokre wabed piny bi wawinje ero chako domomit ndi
tu and a mic.
Podcast makende.
Why the right dislikes foreigners. It's hard sometimes to avoid going down a historical black hole when talking about the right's dislike of foreigners, because that's usually where the answers lie. However, if I go too far back, people will moan about that no longer being relevant. Yet recently in the UK, some right-winger mentioned the Magna Carta being pulled apart by the new Labour PM, and a lot of his supporters were truly horrified. The Magna Carta was signed in 1215, between an unpopular king and some barons who didn't really like him. So if you're currently unemployed and feeling underrepresented by the political mainstream, the Magna Carta isn't going to help you out much. It is a great part of English history, though. So I'll moderate my historical references somewhat. I won't go back to the horrors of British imperialism. I won't go back to the East India Company. I won't even refer to the Berlin Conference in 1884 to 1885, where European countries carved up the continent of Africa for themselves without the presence of a single African representative. Imagine that for a moment happening the other way around. a meeting of African nations get together, say, in Lagos, and decide to split Europe into different colonial possessions and then sending forces. Not people in dinghies, by the way. We're talking really big ships. First with trade goods, then setting up businesses, establishing trade rules and exclusivity contracts, then creating official positions and meeting politicians and influencing decisions, then taking over, using armies to bully, butcher and maim, carve up, kill and conquer. No reasonable nation would ever dream of doing that to another, right? Reality is dynamic. It is many things all at once. It has many shapes and shades, and it can bend to the will of the observer in real time and be completely broken any time thereafter. It can be repaired, but not without a cost. What I mean is, what we know is not always everything that occurred. Propaganda plays a role in how we approach certain events. Words are used deliberately to shape our opinions. After the event, history, which the event by then has become, can be fixed, but imagine at what cost. And usually it is a cost that has been paid for heavily in lives lost. Such costs can never be repaid. One reality we must contend with in the discourse of whiteness in political terms is the diminished value of the white male in white European society. A more accurate reality would be to emphasize the working class nature of this person. Because where today right-wing politicians are pointing our awkward glances towards the suffering of the white male on the basis of his color, they are cleverly hiding the true object of that suffering, his social status. The reason for this is that the white male shares that social status with white females, black males, black females, brown males, and brown females, not mentioning other variants and genders. This is not by accident. Over the last few decades, the proportion of wealth within the economy to which a working class person can ever hope to attain has decreased decidedly. This is borne out from charts measuring the gap between rich and poor. Value within the economy has grown, owing to inflation. Since economic policy actively pushed home ownership, that value has grown astronomically. However, what percentage of that expanded economy was retained by working class families? In some cases, that's a trick question, as those working class families who were able to retain their homes through the 80s and pay off their mortgages stepped into the middle class, thereby reducing the amount of wealth belonging to the lowest band. So we should include lower middle class in any proper evaluation. We should include finance models that targeted poorer families with secure assets as a means of latching on to those assets. Loans and financial vehicles have rarely given much of a care for social justice. For decades, we have seen how education and health services have lost their sheen too. Premium services delivered at premium prices have retained their standards. Lesser services have regressed. The neoliberal New Labour government performed better than any other in terms of healthcare provision through waiting list shortening and service provision. However, some people have pointed to the system simply moving people from waiting lists to secondary lists. These figures need to be checked for accuracy. So instead, let us look at things somewhat differently, and at the same time, look at some of the statements emanating from right-wing media. The white person, especially the white man, has become the object of hate and abuse, and the right-wing political parties such as the Tories, UKIP, the Brexit Party and Reform have become the champions of these poor people, especially the men, because these men have been unfairly criticized by the left. These men have become subjected to hateful ridicule, which undermines their very being. This form of ridicule is completely unfair, especially when considering how these men fought in the war, or their grandfathers did, against fascism and Nazism. They rebuilt the country from the ashes with their bare hands. They made Britain into a nation to be respected again. Right-wing commentators are not stupid. They know exactly who they are speaking to and why. They know what they want to achieve and how. They know that their existence lies in the cultivation of a new generation of followers. The problem for them was that such followers did not exist in the kind of numbers they wanted. Right-wingers are, in general, elitists. I know you have people who are absolutely poor and still right-wing, but that is because they have been tricked into believing that the wealth of the nation is dependent on their support, and in sharing in the glory of their nation's wealth, they will themselves become enriched in some way. Yet right-wing leaders are few, and they don't really go in for hard work. They want positions of authority whereby others work for them. They just want to arrange pieces on a board, sip whiskey, and be served by beautiful people. That means very few right-wingers are actually teachers or lecturers or nurses, etc. These roles are dominated by people who actually want to serve their communities and help children. These people want to work for the good of society. They prioritize social projects. They can be loosely described as socialists. And when these social people teach kids, well, they will teach kids social lessons. Here is the crux. This is why the educational sector has been so severely hampered and beaten down these past few decades. So a popular narrative espoused by the right is that the British white male, who did so much for Queen and country, now no longer has a place of respect in the British social and political system. So as to blame someone that fits right-wing political objectives, those targets need to be specific and over yonder. Right-wing elite neoliberal politicians will hardly accept responsibility for their own enrichment at the cost of the average citizen. Oh no, that is a narrative that needs to be massaged. I recently listened to a podcast by a popular right-wing commentator, and her arguments I have listed here. I have added my own commentary to her points. She said that the white guys of the past were cool. I may be paraphrasing. So let's look at some of her more in-depth analysis. They were funny. People are still funny. I don't know a single person who has ever said that this is not possible. I imagine that this statement refers to the changing nature of racial slur appreciation. If in the 70s and 80s it was funny to make jokes at the expense of foreigners who had little opportunity to respond and who simply had to suck it up because that was British humour, then thankfully we no longer live in the 70s and 80s. Technology has developed since the 70s and 80s too. I don't hear people crying out that we should drive 40-year-old cars, sport 40-year-old hairstyles, or carry 40-year-old mobile phones. Yeah, things develop, they change, they sometimes even improve. It was never funny to laugh at people from a culture that had been barbarically and systematically dismantled structurally and culturally so as to make them more profitable to their colonial overlords. If people did then, now that they know better, what justification can there be to continue doing so today? Point two, they were hardworking. I don't understand some of these points. Again, I think white people are still hardworking. In fact, I strongly believe most people are hardworking, especially when given a chance in life. As a socialist, I do not automatically assume that any group of individuals isn't hardworking. Yet apparently the left have exactly such an opinion. Is it really the left that has inspired these sentiments? Point number three, they brought money home to their wives. Okay, this point is one I fundamentally have problems with. Men brought money home to their wives. For a start, I'm happy that this particular relationship dynamic is no longer the case. In fact, I'm surprised that anyone would want this dynamic to return, unless, of course, they would include people whose opinion of women was less than complimentary. Women are independent and should always have been. Men did not give women their independence. Women very much reclaimed, with their own actions, what they had always deserved to have. men had never had the right to take it away. As for men bringing money back home, whatever arrangement families have is up to them, but with the cost of living being what it is, most families would probably benefit from having more than one money earner. Point number four. They could afford to live. Just about. Again, this is an interesting point. For some reason, foreigners have been blamed for the modern inabilities of white people to live in the luxurious manner white people had become accustomed to in the 70s and 80s. Well, for a start, this is a fallacy. The 70s and 80s may have been a boom time for the yuppies, but the working classes only experienced luxury if they worked in the service of richer people, and in this way, they were the ornaments of luxury and not consumers of luxury. Since the 70s and 80s, since monetarism and the neoliberal policies of almost every Western nation and party, is it a wonder that people can hardly afford to buy homes? Are right-wing commentators suggesting that foreigners introduced economic policy in the UK or elsewhere? Did foreigners really have that much influence? Point number five. They had friends, went to the pub, etc., etc. They can't do many of these things now. Why can't they meet friends at the pub anymore? Did the local pubs close after the smoking ban? Did the financial crash take the pubs under? Did COVID do away with the pubs? Which of these were caused by foreigners? The point I'm trying to make is a simple one. There are a variety of reasons why events unfolded in the manner in which they did. Foreigners did not close coal mines in the 1980s, and a better planned phase-out would have taken local needs into consideration. Foreigners did not sell off British industries. Foreigners did not privatize vast public services that would eventually price them out of using them. Foreigners didn't asset strip public transport, communications, and health services. Foreigners didn't constantly rejig the education sector so that teachers came more and more under pressure by dealing with red tape rather than teaching. Foreigners did not sell too many subprime mortgages to people who couldn't afford them just to hit their targets. Foreigners didn't raise interest rates to provide more money to millionaires with savings, all the while screwing little people to pay for their cash injections. Poor people didn't raise the cost of heating over winter to then give BP and other oil giants billions in profits. The list goes on and on. When people mention the things that have been taken away from them, we should actually think back and try to remember who actually took those things away. When you see foreigners working in blue-collar positions, you should also remember that on occasion, people who arrive are desperate and will work for anything they can get. Employers decide to pay them less because they make more money from doing so. Companies either send their services abroad or pay people as little as they can get away with. If you have been wronged by someone, regardless of their skin color or religion, then that is the person who has wronged you. It should not become an excuse to dislike everyone of that race and religion. If a system wrongs you and people like you, then it is the system that needs to be addressed. People will defend their system because it is the basis of the world they have always known. And yes, even though that basis should be dismantled for the falsehoods that prop it up to be revealed, we should seek to do so with peaceful methods and with delicate application. It is important to build a society together thereafter, and to do this, we need to make friends, not enemies, with our opponents.
Two. And a mic. Two. And a mic. Two. And a mic. Two.